New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says he hopes the failure of an Atlantic City bill to come up for a vote today will lead lawmakers to get beyond the political drama and support his plan. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A vote on the assembly measure supported by Democratic Speaker Vince Prieto was canceled. It would have given Atlantic City 2 years to fix its finances before the most drastic measures of a state takeover could kick in. Christie and Senate President Steve Sweeney are insisting on their own plan, and Christie says he's disappointed the Assembly Speaker spent weeks pushing a bill that ended up having to withdraw because it lacked enough votes for approval.
This has been a waste of time, a waste of money, and much too much drama over something that never had any real opportunity to pass.
The bills differ in how long they would give Atlantic City to stabilize its finances before the state could cancel union contracts or sell city assets. Christie says Atlantic City could run out of cash in 10 days. There's a time-tested tradition in political campaigns that the general election battles get underway around Labor Day. Media consultants would say it's not worth putting TV ads on, at least until the election is drawing close and voters are paying attention. WHYY's Dave Davies says that thinking has gone out the window in Pennsylvania's U.S. Senate race.
Literally minutes after Democrat Katie McGinty claimed victory, Republican incumbent Pat Toomey issued a blistering press release attacking her personal integrity. TV ads followed within hours, and McGinty's allies have responded.
Katie McGinty makes government work for her, not for us.
Pat Toomey started his career as an investment banker, then a Wall Street wheeler dealer.
Why are we seeing ads 6 months before anybody can cast a vote for senator? Well, Toomey has a $9 million campaign fund, and Franklin and Marshall professor Stephen Medvick says Toomey has a chance to shape voter perceptions of his opponent early.
He might think that McGinty's undefined enough at this point that he can really define her and can frame this campaign from the very beginning of it.
So we see attacks like this, which is part of a $500,000 ad campaign from the Club for Growth.
Katie McGinty profited from the revolving door of government and politics while working for the state. McGinty gave millions in grants to her husband's company.
Toomey spent 4 years running the Club for Growth after he left his congressional seat and before he ran for Senate. Medvick says it's interesting that the early shots at McGinty aren't the typical Republican attacks on Democrats as being irresponsible tax and spenders. He says this message taps the widespread voter anger that's been fueling the candidacies of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders.
It's a populist appeal. It's saying, here's somebody who's an elite, who spent a lot of time in government, but when she wasn't in government, she was in the private sector, and she's been sort of benefiting from that, as they say, that revolving door.
Is it true McGinty gave millions in grants to her husband's company? No. There was a 2007 controversy about her department funding an environmental nonprofit, which her husband did consulting work for, and the State Ethics Commission said she should avoid any role in future grants. But her husband's earnings, less than $4,000, were a tiny fraction of the funding, which began under a Republican governor. It is true, as Toomey alleges, that after McGinty left the state, she had a paid board position with a company that had benefited from state grants. She says she's proud of the company she's worked with and notes she's gotten the support of environmental groups. McGinty's allies have answered the Toomey ads. There's one from the Public Employee Union, AFSCME, and this from the state Democratic Party.
But let's look at the real Pat Toomey. He was a Wall Street banker, making millions while making nothing. Then in Congress, Toomey carried water for Wall Street.
It's true Toomey worked in the financial sector before entering politics, and he has a different view of government regulation than Democrats. But Toomey says he opposed the bank bailout and other public subsidies to business. It's a subject certain to be debated further as the campaign unfolds. As for the volleys of negative ads, Medvick says we shouldn't assume they'll let up anytime soon.
Both campaigns are going to be well-funded, and I think in the fall, there's also going to be probably a lot of campaign spending at the presidential level. And so I think they figured the airwaves may be crowded and noisy. And so I think they think right now would be the time to get their message through.
There is one positive note in the ad blitz. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has one featuring former Eagle Vince Papale telling voters Toomey is a good guy. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Rape kits contain DNA evidence that can identify an unknown assailant, confirm a survivor's account of the attack, and exonerate an innocent suspect. Trying to cut down on the backlog of untested rape kits is the goal of ILSA Connect, Director of Policy and Advocacy at End the Backlog. It's an initiative of the Joyful Heart Foundation. ILSA, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
How prolific is the problem?
Well, the backlog is something that every community across the country seems to have in common with each other. We don't really have a clear picture of how large the backlog is because law enforcement agencies are lacking the infrastructure often to track and keep an inventory of such kits.
All levels, local, state, and federal?
That's correct.
What are some of the factors that account for the backlog?
One of the top reasons for the backlog is the lack of prioritization of sexual assault crimes and not dedicating sufficient resources to sexual assault cases in many law enforcement agencies.
Is that because it's a discretionary matter at many law enforcement agencies?
That's correct. Most law enforcement agencies, first of all, lack clear policies. So there is a systemic failure to take sexual assault seriously and to, in many cases, properly investigate the crimes, prioritize these cases, and really to dedicate sufficient resources to it.
What are those resources in terms of dollars per kit?
That ranges from anywhere really from $500 per kit, which is pretty low, to $2,000 per kit.
Let's focus then on the Philadelphia region and then Pennsylvania. Where does it stand relative to other municipalities and states?
It's very difficult for us to compare between jurisdictions and between states because you have population differences. You, of course, have differences in crime statistics and resources in general. So we like to just focus in on the fact that Pennsylvania is now doing what we believe is the first step to reform, which is creating an inventory and getting a real idea about the number of untested kits that are in the state.
You are joining us from New York City, which I understand is in the vanguard toward this end.
That's right. New York City tests every rape kit and has done so for quite a long time and is really on that cutting edge of taking sexual assault crimes seriously and really sending a message to sexual assault survivors in New York City that what happened to them matters.
What are the factors that account for that success in New York City, and are any of those variables applicable in, say, Philadelphia?
I think they can be applied anywhere. It's really about taking a step to ensure that every kit is swiftly tested, that elected officials at every level of government ensure that sufficient funding is dedicated to processing untested rape kits or all rape kits, also to investigating leads and moving cases forward to prosecution.
Again, this initiative and the backlog is part of the Joyful Heart Foundation. What is its mission?
We created the End the Backlog Project to shine a light on the backlog of untested rape kits throughout the United States and to promote comprehensive rape kit reform. Part of our work here is also ensuring that we uncover the true numbers of untested rape kits across the country because we don't know. There is no national tracking system for it.
ILSA, of course, the point of the kit is to help the survivor.
It's important for us to remember that each one of these kits represents a survivor who not only endured a horrific experience, but then also went through a 4 to 6 hour forensic examination when really probably she or he only wanted to go home and take a shower. And we owe it to them to treat their evidence carefully, the evidence that they had so painstakingly collected from their body, which is really a living, breathing crime scene. These survivors have done everything that society asks of them. We really need to do everything possible to help them find a path to justice and healing.
ILSA, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you so much for having me and for covering this important story.
ILSA Connect is Director of Policy and Advocacy at End the Backlog, an initiative of the Joyful Heart Foundation. Still ahead this evening, not much is known about the gay rights activist known as Dr. Anonymous, and that's exactly what attracted one playwright to his story.
To do something incredibly dramatic and then to go back into your private life and not seek to be remembered is dramatic to me.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. A new play opens this week at Philadelphia's Painted Bride Art Center about Dr. Anonymous. He's the psychiatrist who in 1972 delivered a speech arguing against treating homosexuality as a mental illness. He wore a mask to hide his true identity because he was gay. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that Dr. Anonymous still holds mysteries.
We now know who Dr. Anonymous was. He was John Fryer, a professor of psychiatry at Temple University. He died in 2003. His papers are stored in 217 boxes at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, which asked the New York-based playwright Ayn Gordon to go through all of them to find material for a play called The 217 Boxes of Dr. Anonymous.
You know, the boxes are not his self-portrait. They're not intentional. He was not intending to tell you who he was vis-a-vis the boxes, but we now treat them as that.
In this play, John Fryer never appears on stage. Instead, three people who knew him well tell sometimes conflicting stories about the man, like his father, Ursel Ray Fryer. He recites his son's infamous speech from the 1972 meeting of the American Psychiatric Association, the APA. He's played by actor Ken Marks.
I am, like many of you here tonight, a member of the APA, and I am proud of that membership. Sorry, you ever worn a rubber mask? The kind that John has on any amount of time? Sweat builds up and runs down your mouth, your eyes, your... It's Dallas, right? It's Dallas, Texas. It's May. It's a windowless ballroom, no air conditioning. My son's a big man, doesn't take to heat.
Outside of people involved in the history of gay rights activism, John Fryer is not very well known, and that's how he wanted it. Aside from his one history-changing moment in 1972, he lived a relatively quiet life in Germantown.
To do something incredibly dramatic and then to go back into your private life and not seek to be remembered is dramatic to me.
Gordon says Fryer was actually a boisterous personality, physically large, with theatrical tastes, but he kept a low public profile, and that was likely learned, says Gordon, as few gay men lived out in the open in mid-20th century America. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
During this National Pet Month, listeners are apt to hear many stories about man, woman, and their pets, but perhaps none as compelling as the one by Colin Campbell. The author joins me now to talk about his book entitled Free Days with George. Colin, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having us, Dave.
Yours is a story where, in a sense, the hunter got captured by the game.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, it's something that was very unexpected in my life, and I was given some strong encouragement by friends to adopt a dog and save a life, and in the process, possibly help my own, and it's exactly how it worked out. The sad reality was that I came home from a business trip. I had a very, you know, decent career and happily married and had a nice house, all those normal things. And then I came home from a business trip one day and my wife, who I loved very much, had decided to leave. So without any recourse, I, you know, really drew into a depression. I didn't manage it well. And I focused on work and that part was fine, but I would go home and develop some pretty bad personal habits to try to, you know, avoid the pain I was feeling.
Until you ran into a therapist named Catherine, who in turn turned you to a psychiatrist.
Right. And, you know, it was the last thing in the world that I ever thought I would want or need to do. And I think a lot of people who go down that road never suspect that this is something that they need.
Ironic, then, that it wasn't a trained therapist, but a friend, Matt, who said, you should get a dog.
He recognized that I was struggling. So eventually I listened to him, and I went out and I found George online, and I adopted him.
What breed?
George is a 140-pound Newfoundland. He struck me online. His face is very soulful. And I thought, you know, I was saving his life and doing him a favor. And as life evolved after that, I realized he was doing me a way bigger favor in return, especially with the depression that I was dealing with.
The book is a chronology, but we need to go back at this point and talk about your grandfather. He introduced you as a young boy to the concept of a free day.
At night, before we would be tucked into bed, he said, boys, you have a good day today. And we said, of course, Grandpa, it was really fun. You know, we built sandcastles and we flew kites and all that stuff. And he said, well, when you do those things with people who love you, that's a free day on earth. You don't get old. and said, boys, we had a free day today. And the whole premise of the name of the book was when George and I ended up out in California surfing together, I realized we had a day like that where I felt I didn't get old, and that's the name of the book.
Listeners might discern a hint of a Canadian accent, and it was a work transfer from Toronto to Los Angeles.
Correct. Just after my marriage ended, and I just after I got George, I was transferred down there, and George and I ended up living two blocks from the beach in L.A.
Now, let's note that when you first acquired George, he was skittish, shall we say.
Yeah, you know, he had been neglected. It was very emotional for me because I wasn't still getting better as fast as I wish I was. And so anytime George made some progress, I took it very personally. And that's part of the whole thing about how he saved me and the lessons I learned from him, because, it was a very personal journey for both of us, and it was a very happy one.
There's a wonderful passage initially when he first smells the surf, and there was no holding him back, regardless of what kind of training he had prior to that moment.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because he'd never seen the ocean before, and I'm not even sure if he ever swam before. So we end up in the Pacific Ocean, standing on the beach. He immediately ran for the ocean, and he saw a surfer out there waiting for a wave. And George, all he did was swim out to this surfer to try and pull him back, because that's what they're bred to do. And it's like the DNA kicked in. And I had to go out and say, George, come on back. And as soon as he saw me in the water, he was determined to come and save me. And it's a bonding moment. It changed our relationship very dramatically, very quickly. And then he just never left my side.
What's this tour like that you're embarked on? I understand we're your second stop of many.
I'm very grateful to my publisher, Penguin Random House. They invested in sending us across the U.S. to go to 26 cities over a 5-week period.
And part of that investment is also you giving back in terms of letting audience members know about avails for homeless pets.
Absolutely. So one of the things I'm very proud of is that Pedigree is helping us sponsor feeding shelter animals with a program called Feed the Good. Their goal is to feed 10 million bowls of food to homeless dogs in the next year. So George and I have the opportunity, when we stop in all the cities, we're going to local shelters and we're donating food on behalf of Pedigree. And then we go to bookstores and we're doing book signings in every city. And we're doing great media interviews like with people like you. It's very exciting.
Thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Dave, thank you very much. Appreciate having us here.
Colin Campbell, author of Free Days with George, One Very Big Dog. You can hear much more of our conversation and check out pictures at newsworks.org. The Philadelphia Theater Company is staging its production of the provocatively titled Sex with Strangers, a new play making the rounds at theaters across the nation. WHYY theater blogger Howard Shapiro offers this review.
The two characters in Laura Eason's compelling play Sex with Strangers meet by chance. Each is expecting to be alone and working on a writing project in a quiet cottage far from the big city. But there's been some misunderstanding, and there they are on a snowy winter's night. Two people who come to realize they each want what the other has. She's an author with respectability. He's an author with money and fame. On the other hand, not many people buy her serious fiction. And he's a sex machine who's often excoriated on the web by the women he's bedded, blogged about, and described in his bestseller called Sex with Strangers. The play looks at the effects of an internet that never forgets. What happens, it asks, when the pixels come home to roost? Joanne Reinhart and Kyle Kaufman are genuine in their portrayals of these two people who believe in the greener gardens of each other but fail to see all the weeds, and David Saint directs the play to feel like it's moving steadily on four wheels. The internet is making for some good drama these days, with characters like these whose lives are defined digitally. What happens on the internet stays on the internet. And that's not always such a good thing. Sex with Strangers runs at the Philadelphia Theater Company's Suzanne Roberts Theater in Center City through May 8th. I'm Howard Shapiro for WHYY.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.